life with many different relationships. There's ones that we are sort of long-term things we walk with, like life partners, kids. Yeah, that one's on quite tight. Long-term friends, family, extended family, relationships. Then there's ones that are, oh my goodness, wait. There's ones that are not so, they're not so permanent for us. The ones of jobs, the ones of stage of life friends, and all those acquaintances. So many acquaintances. Baggage. But relationships aren't actually necessarily, baggage is a bad thing. Relationships are wonderful. And that's because we are made by a relational God, a God who is in essence relationship itself. Father, Son, and Spirit intertwined and always loving, always giving, always knowing, so close and intimate that they're seen as one. And we're made out of that, not just to need, not just to want, but to need deep and close relationships. So of course they're wonderful. Of course they're the most helpful, beautiful, delicious, life-giving and nurturing things in life. But I'd be lying if I didn't admit that they're also really complex, painful, messy, and heavy. So heavy. People can hurt us. Well, because, hang on. And the reason they're hurt, the reason that is so that they are hard and they're heavy was the fact that from the moment that the first people decided to go their own way in the Garden of Eden, it broke something. A crack of brokenness ran throughout the whole of creation, cracking and distorting and breaking everything, every single aspect of creation. And that crack also went through relationships and still does. There is a pervasive sense that our relationships aren't exactly as they ought to be. And so because of that, that's why our relationships feel so heavy, is because of that brokenness, people hurt and wound us. They do this unintentionally, but also intentionally. They can hurt us by not thinking about their words and their actions. They can hurt us by their mistakes. They can hurt us with their good intentions. And they can hurt us with the spillovers of their own problems. Or they can hurt us intentionally because they think we deserve it. And these hurts that we tend to hold, they differ in size and effect as well. Some wounds are superficial. Annoyances, jabs and cuts to our self-esteem, disappointments because of unmet expectations. But on the other hand, there were some really deep and painful wounds. And I think we all know what that feels like. And the natural reaction of humans to hurts and pains is to hold them close. Because they're part of us, they're personal, aren't they? We live in a culture which we're very aware of what's fair for us. And if I've noticed a trend on social media in the last few years, that there's heaps of inspirational quotes and sayings and little memes that come up that pretty much in essence say, if a relationship is hurtful, cut it loose. And that might be healthy in some times, but what that fails to realise is the crucial fact that whether or not you discard a relationship, the baggage actually stays with you. The pain and the hurt sticks around. Whether or not that person is dead or gone or out of your life, this the unforgiveness still remains, the hurt still remains. So what do we do with all this hurt that clings and makes heavy? What does Jesus say? I think we all know, don't we? What does the Lord's Prayer say about it? Can anyone quote it? Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. And we forgive our debts as we have also been forgiven our debtors. Or transgressions, or however the translation is. We know that. But I'd like to unpack another passage in the Bible where Jesus talks about it, a bit further on in Matthew, actually. We're going to read from Matthew 18. Halfway through the chapter, starting at verse 21, where Jesus is speaking to his closest circle of followers about how to do life and relationship in the family of faith. And so we pick it up at verse 21. We can have it on the screen. Peter comes up to him and asks, "Lord, how often should I forgive someone who sins against me? Seven times?" Now, I'll stop the reading there to just let you know, but where do you get that number from? Was that just a pull-it-out-the-air number? In Jewish law and tradition at that time, the law required you to forgive three times. But after that, fourth onwards, anyone guess? You're on your own. You can if you want to, but you're not required to. So Peter's like, I know. What I know about Jesus, I've been around him for a while now, I know that he is ridiculously over the top and out there. Whatever the law says, he just does a little crazy twist to it. So I reckon I'll double it and then some. So Jesus, seven times? What do you think Jesus says? No, not seven times. But 70 times 7. Maths withers, what's 70 times 7? 490. Some translations say 77 times. But I think we can agree either way that either 77 or 490 is a darn sight more than 3. A stupid, ridiculous, over-the-top number more than 3. And so Jesus, in his way, of course, likes to illustrate then with a story. He isn't just all about the maths. So he tells a story. He says, "Therefore, the kingdom of heaven can be compared to a king who decided to bring his accounts up to date with his servants who had borrowed money from him. In the process, one of his debtors was brought to him who owed him millions of dollars. He couldn't pay. So his master ordered that he be sold, along with his wife and his children and everything he owned, to pay that debt. But the man, he fell down before his master and he begged him, 'Please, please be patient with me, I'll pay it all.' Then his master was filled with pity for him and released him and forgave his debt. But when the man left the king, he went to a fellow servant who owed him a few thousand dollars. He grabbed him by the throat and demanded instant payment. His fellow servant fell down before him and begged him for a little more time. 'Be patient with me and I will pay it,' he begged. But his creditor would not wait. He had the man arrested and put into prison until the debt was paid in full. And that," Jesus said, "is what my heavenly Father will do to you if you refuse to forgive your brothers and sisters from your heart." Jesus isn't being tricky with his words, is he? He seems pretty clear at what he's getting at. There's a few things I'd like to unpack out of that passage, but before we do, it's time for a little bit of maths. Because this version, the NLT, talks in millions of dollars. But in the traditional translations, or the traditional language, it talks in two units of measurements, which you may have read in your Bibles before. There's a measurement of a denarii, and this person owed 100 denarii, the second servant. And the first servant, can you remember, anyone know how much he owed? 10,000 talents, which doesn't clear things up anymore. What's a talent? What's a denarii? Apples and oranges. It's hard to actually compare the two. So let's work it out. I looked it up. A denarii was a day's wage, like a bog standard day's wage for a servant or labourer or someone. So 100 denarii is 100 days' wages. It's about between a quarter and a third of a year's wages. Decent. The first guy's dead. So one talent is 6,000 denarii. One talent, 6,000 days' wages. So what's 10,000 times 6,000? 60 million! 60 million days' wages. That is, let me tell you, 1,640,000 years of seven a day labour, which is about 4,000 lifetimes. Let me show it to you visually. Rigsies, it's time to shine. Wait a moment. Hang on. Let's get some of our baggage put to good use, hey? Yep, pour it. Go. Let's say that 100 denarii, a third of a year's wages, is one lupin. A lupin is a legume, often used for stock feed. So that is a couple of thousand dollars, well, several thousand dollars, a third of a year's wages, all right? If that, on one hand, is 100 denarii, 100 days' wages, this is a visual. Yeah, I did maths. This is a visual of what the other guy's debt was. Ready? Oh, more! That is the difference. One debt, the other debt. 60 million days of life. So I think my first point is pretty obvious. This is not just a big debt. This is an unpayable debt, isn't it? It was an impossible debt. The servant could never pay back the king. And yet, what did he say? Be patient with me, give me more time and I'll pay it back. Are you kidding? The king realized this and took pity, took great heartfelt compassion on the man. He saw how hard he was striving and went, I'm going to release you from the need to ever try to pay back this impossible debt. I'm going to give you freedom from a lifetime of trying and then actually failing to pay off this debt. He was moved to act compassionately. No more time, It was just full and complete forgiveness of the debt. Such generosity of the king. And I wonder, this speaks a lot. I wonder if the servant actually realized how much he was forgiven. That it was more than just a, oh, thanks, but you shouldn't have. That it was impossible for him to have paid it back. So, in this parable, it's pretty clear, it's no secret, that the king figure is a representation or a picture of God, isn't it? So what does this tell us about God, our king? What does it tell us about the character of God? That he is abundantly, amazingly, gloriously, possibly foolishly generous. And merciful, and kind, and loving, and compassionate. And then I guess it's pretty clear then that the other servants in the story are people, are us, are humans. Are we like that servant? The fact that he thought he could pay it back? Are we maybe trying to get ourselves into God's good graces? Bear with, we'll get there. Just give me a bit of time. I know it looks big, but trust me, I've got this sorted. Under control, God. Call you if I need. Do we still think we could pull our way out through our failings against God? The second point I want to make is about the smaller debt. You hear a lot of this parable if you've been around church circles for a while. You hear this, it sort of goes, well, look at this debt, look at this debt. You've been forgiven this much, surely you can't forgive this much, surely. And you walk away going, then why is it so hard? Because I want to let you know that the smaller debt is actually still significant. I said before that it was 100 days' wages. Like, if someone owed my family a third of a year's wages, that actually is make it or break it for us. I'd actually be wanting to get it back. That's a significant loss for my family and would impact our quality of life. So I want to acknowledge today that the hurts and the baggage and the wounds that we feel, the things that make our relationships heavy, are actually heavy. And I'm not trying to dismiss that. And it's not a whole thing of, well, there you go. Like, it's not that. These are heavy. They might look small to other people, but the weight and the accumulation of them is really heavy and significant. And it's a natural reaction to want our debts paid in full. But, in going on with the story, unforgiveness has consequences. In the story, the king revokes his goodwill to the servant when he hears of his unforgiveness and sends him off to be tortured, or at least put in jail where he may be tortured as a result. Now, I actually don't think there's a one-to-one comparison in this story about that king and God. It's a picture. Because if you did, I don't think our God is malicious and vindictive like that. I think the Bible speaks again and again and again of God's long-suffering graciousness. So we need to take this story in the light of what we know about God through the entire scriptures. But there is a kingdom principle here. Forgiving is the key to being forgiven. Forgiving is the key to freedom. Because if we're honest, what's the alternative to forgiveness? A Catholic, old Catholic priest called Lewis Smeads writes a pretty epic book on forgiveness that a lot of people, Christian and non-Christian, actually quote. And he sort of outlines what the actual alternative to the hard thing of forgiveness is. He says we become bitter. If you don't forgive, you become bitter. And bitterness glues us to the wretched past, he says. Does that ring true for you? Something you're holding on to, gluing you to the wretched past? Also, the alternative is that we hold a grudge. And what do grudges do? They close the door to reconciliation. And that, what's wrong with that? Yeah, I totally want to close that door. I don't want to deal with this. But what that does, it actually locks us into a ceaseless process of self-destruction, according to Smeeds. A ceaseless process of self-destruction. And the third thing is that we, if we don't forgive, we seek revenge. And the thing about revenge is vengeance is never wholly satisfying. And it gets us stuck in an endless repetition of getting even and getting even, which can continue for generations. I think we know about that, don't we? So all of this, bitterness and grudges and revenge and vengeance, they look very much like the opposite of freedom, don't they? They look very much like being locked up on our inside. But in all this, please don't get me wrong, that forgiveness doesn't actually excuse a wrong. In fact, forgiveness actually acknowledges the responsibility of the wrongdoer. You were just choosing not to let it go. To forgive, you first need to hold someone to account for their actions. Interestingly, Jesus talks about this very clearly earlier in the same passage, like just before. It's actually, that conversation is actually what prompted Peter's original question about how many times do I need to forgive? So verse 15 onwards, it goes, if another member of the church sins against you, go and point out the fault when two of you are alone. If the member listens to you, well, you have regained that one. But if you're not listened to, then take two other people along with you so that the word may be confirmed by evidence of two or three witnesses. If the member refuses to even listen to them, then tell the church. If the offender refuses to even listen to the church, then such one will be to you as a Gentile or a tax collector. On the outer. So that gives a really good point. I'm not sort of dwelling on this part of the text, but it says to actually seek to bring up an issue. If there's an issue, seek to bring it up with the people involved so that forgiveness and reconciliation can actually be reached. And others actually may be needed to be called into the situation to help achieve that. That is good and that is right, because it's hard. The other thing is there's a habit, and I think maybe more among lovely Christian people, about smothering conflict. And that can sometimes look like forgiveness, but it isn't. In fact, smothering actually robs both yourself and the other person the chance to experience the freedom that forgiveness brings. I was working in a group setting just recently, and a young person in that group had done something really quite full-on. And the next day, he came back and he wanted to actually express to a few people his forgiveness, and that he was really sorry. And there was one worker who he really needed to speak to, and on his own bat, he came up and said, "Look, I just want to say I'm really sorry." Before he could even finish what he was saying, she goes, "No, no, 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 no. You don't need to forgive. There's nothing to forgive. There's nothing to forgive." And I went, oh, and I stepped in as actually, but I think he needs to do this. Like her just trying to, you know, be the bigger person actually was locking him out of getting the freedom of actually asking and seeking and receiving forgiveness. And maybe we do that too. We like to smother conflict because maybe there's a bit of control there as well. I don't know. But we smother and we don't want to deal with it. Or we smother our own issues and go, no, 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 there's nothing. There's nothing I don't need. I'm not hurt. I'm really not hurt. It's not heavy. They're not heavy, these relationships. But that's not the way to forgiveness, is it? So how do we do it? Look, I don't know. I don't know what hurts you're carrying close. And you don't know mine. And to be honest, I'm not a psychologist or a counsellor, so I'm pretty foggy with the specific steps to lead you on that incredible journey and painful journey of forgiveness. But this is what I do know. What I do know is the King, our King, King Jesus. The crux of this parable, the picture to take away, is not a comparison picture, but it is a picture of an absurdly, wildly, utterly generous and forgiving King. One who possibly put his entire kingdom in peril and jeopardy and financial instability to pay off that debt. But such was his mercy. Our King Jesus, he loved all the way to a crushing death, where he paid off all our debts to him and each other once and for all. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And he didn't just stay there. He rose. He rose in victory over that debt with wealth to spare. And our King invites him to join him, to sit by his feet and be like him. So I wonder if the story had a different twist to it. I wonder what would have happened when the servant was forgiven a debt and was like, oh my gosh, thank you. And then went out and saw the guy who owed him something. And he's like, ah, okay, so you've forgiven me this debt, but I still have nothing in my pocket. And I still have to feed my family and it still hurts. And it's still big what you've got against me. But what about instead of choking that servant and wanting demanding instant payment, what about if he raced back to the King? Don't you think he could rely on the character of the King that he just witnessed? Don't you think he could rely on that character of the King to go, do you know what, I've got this too. I've got it. Trust me to give not only all that you have, but to make up the lack in others. Trust me, I've got it. So talk to Jesus about your hurts. Talk to Jesus what's in your relationships and making them heavy. And instead of being beautiful things to carry through life, they're burdensome. So what I'd love you to do is actually, I wonder if you can get the Rigsies back up here for me. I'd love you guys, they're going to pass around a few buckets. Well, I'm going to get them to walk around with some buckets of lupins. I'd love you to take a couple, take a handful, take one, take a few. And as we sing the last song, I'd like you to roll them around in your hand. Have a feel of them. Maybe it's easy to relate each lupin to someone you need. Something's been niggling you as I've been talking. Maybe there's unforgiveness or not just unforgiveness, but maybe there's hurts and sorrows that you carry. And what I'd love you to do is as we sing this last song about Jesus' amazing love, God's amazing love, and Jesus being our King. If you'd like to take those home to remind you, pop them on your windowsill, pop them next to your bed, pop one in your shoe. Maybe the niggliness will help you realize that it's a big thing. But if you would like to take one of those lupins during our last song and come out the front, come over here to the chair of our glorious and gracious King. And if you would like, as a sign that you're willing to start walking that road of forgiveness with King Jesus by your side and in his power, then pop your lupin on here as an acknowledgement that it's a big debt, but it is nothing in comparison to this utterly gracious, loving, generous King that we serve.